Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. In the last week, somebody, and I honestly forget who, asked me to give a talk on upekkha for this Wednesday night talk. The subject of upekkha is something which I very rarely talk about. It's a very profound subject, and it needs to be understood very well how to apply that to one's daily practice and the practice of meditation. Obviously, the best part of upekkha is that which happens after the attainment of the ending of craving. And one can say that the one who's ended all craving, all tanha, because they are not out there to manipulate the world except out of compassion, except out of loving kindness, they will mostly practice this upekkha, this looking on, this gazing on, without being involved in the world. However, that's the exalted state of the arahat. In the meantime, that we have to know how we can use this concept, this practice of upekkha in our daily lives, and especially in the practice of meditation. Sometimes that upekkha can be very easily misinterpreted as just allowing the defilements just to roll along. One of the problems with that idea of upekkha, that sort of equanimity in the face of defilements, is that sometimes without enough clarity of mindfulness, without enough wisdom, one really thinks one is looking on, but in actual fact one is doing something. Sometimes the degree of mindfulness, the degree of clarity of the mind to really discern whether one is practicing equanimity or not is very high. And so you have to be very careful of this practice of equanimity. Sometimes people will think that defilements, if I just leave them alone, do nothing, just watch, just practice equanimity. If lust comes up, I'll just be equanimous about it. If anger comes up, I'll just be equanimous about it. This is just the way things are. This is the way things happen. Just let go, let go. In effect, one is not letting go. All of the defilements, the three kilesas of sensory desire, ill will, and delusion, all of those defilements, one feeds them. One feeds these things. And by feeding these things, we can see that we're not really practicing equanimity at all. One of the beautiful descriptions of equanimity from Ajahn Chah is a simile of the leaves on the tree. So those leaves on a tree, they shake, they go backwards and forwards, only when there's a wind. If the wind dies down, or if the tree is protected from the wind, so that the air around it is not moving, that the air is still, then the leaf will vibrate less and less and less, until eventually it will come to a stop. So the sign that equanimity is actually being practiced is that stillness is growing in the mind, that peace is developing, that the mind is becoming more and more empty of movement. And this is how we know that equanimity is being practiced, that things start to get more peaceful. So, bearing that in mind, we can see that the practice of equanimity in the early stages of the practice is done as a skillful means in overcoming some of the defilements which arise from time to time. First of all, we must recognize that things like ill will, anger, are never justified. Things like sensory desire is always missing the point of the holy life. And to recognize that underneath all of these things is a huge amount of delusion. And sometimes that we buy into that delusion by believing ourselves and arguing with the teacher, arguing with the teachings, and believing in that delusion. It's wonderful to have that humility to be able to admit that, no, I'm not a stream winner yet, no, I'm not an anagami, no, I'm not an arahat yet, to acknowledge that inside of yourselves, so that you do realize that you don't know, and you can have a bit more trust and faith in the teachings of the Buddha or the teachers. Now, bearing that in mind, those teachings of the Buddha actually show that you can know whether the path is being trodden, you can know whether you are practicing the right way, if those defilements get less and less and less. And we can understand the path to lessening those defilements with all the skillful means which the Buddha gave to us. The Eightfold Path. In particular, in this talk about equanimity, you have to put it alongside the Four Right Efforts. Because this certainly was one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path which confused me for many years. How can you put forth effort and then practice equanimity at the same time? Surely that samavayama, right effort, is the antithesis, it's the opposite of equanimity when you're just supposed to do nothing. But a closer examination of the meaning of the Four Right Efforts, you know, which are sort of striving, grabbing hold of the mind, initiating energy, working hard to abandon unwholesome states which are already arisen, to keep unwholesome states yet to arise from entering the mind, to develop wholesome states of mind, and to maintain the wholesome states of mind already arisen. That's what's called right effort. It really depends upon the goal, what you want to achieve. You want to abandon and keep out unwholesome states. You want to arouse and maintain wholesome states of mind. How you do that depends upon the circumstances. As you know, there are times when we grab hold of the mind, we actually do something. And there are times where we just practice the equanimity. And it's knowing what to do when makes one the skillful practitioner. It's like the pain we experience from time to time in monastic life, the physical pain and the pain of disappointments, the pain of doing things we don't want to do. All of those things, that they are problems for the mind. And we can do one of two things. We can actually try and overcome the obstacle, try and work hard, try and do something. But sometimes there's nothing we can do, and all we need is just some equanimity. Very often that's the case with physical pain. You try and go to the doctors, you try and do exercises, you try and change your diets, whatever it is, sometimes it works, but often it doesn't. And so the practice of effort means that there's times when you try and do something, but when there's nothing can be done, then you have equanimity. What equanimity does, it doesn't just mean enduring. The equanimity should always be practiced alongside of investigation. Because otherwise the equanimity will not be able to be maintained, and the equanimity will just turn into more problems. The equanimity which goes alongside the investigation, especially with pain, means you're not going to try to get rid of the unpleasant physical feelings in your mind at the time. But you're not just going to grit your teeth either. The equanimity should be done with a sense of interest, with a sense of investigation, with a sense of curiosity, finding out what these things really are. And that is like the advantage of dukkha vedana, of physical pain. You need to be able to watch it with equanimity in the same way that a scientist needs to watch the experiment without any vested interest in what they're going to find. Because if you're looking for something, you're looking to prove your pet theory, then you'll never have that that evenness of mind. You'll never have the equanimity to be able to really see the truth. You'll only see what you're looking for. That's what delusion is all about. With the equanimity, you have to put aside all prejudgment. Just all past has to be put aside, because the prejudgments arise from all the past experiences and the past biases. With equanimity, you have to look upon that object which you're finding painful as if it's the first time you've ever seen it in your life, putting aside all past and all future. And if you can so do, then you can really see that thing clearly, and you can investigate it, and you can find out what that pain really means and how it works. And it gives you a lot of freedom in life, and especially monastic life, to understand this thing called physical pain. As you get older, the physical pain will increase. As you get older, the body will be less able to overcome these things. And it will get worse and worse and worse until one day the pain will get so great that you'll die. And that's your future, and my future, and everybody's future. So you have to have some understanding of that pain, some understanding of that discomfort. And that's physical pain. That's body awareness, body contemplation, because this is where that physical pain usually lies. If we can do this and look upon it with equanimity and investigation, we can gain a lot of freedom from pain. We get a lot of freedom from the fear of pain. So often that pain is fearsome because we never really know, we're always running away, trying to overcome it, never just stopping to look at it with equanimity and finding out exactly what it is. As the Buddha said, there's two aspects to pain. There's the two thorns, the mental thorn, the physical thorn. And the mental thorn you can take out. The mental thorn of not wanting, not being at peace with, not accepting that physical pain. That's something you can do. The physical pain, very often you can do nothing about. It's there until you die. But taking away that mental thorn, the mental dart, is something you can do from time to time. The Arahat has done that all the time. But the Putuchana, even the stream winner, Wantutana Anagami, sometimes that thorn is still there, the mental thorn. But you can pull it out. So you really are looking upon that thing with just equanimity. And as I said earlier, you know that you've got equanimity in mind. When everything gets peaceful, when there's no struggle anymore, when there's no craving, when there's no desire to have anything else other than you have right now. If it's full equanimity, it gives rise to a beautiful stillness and peace in the mind. And of course, the deep reason for this is the doer cannot coexist with equanimity. Equanimity is consciousness clear and bright without the doer. That's pure equanimity. However, for many people they think equanimity is there, but they're still doing things. It's not really equanimous. It's not just looking on. It's looking on and getting involved. So we can practice this with physical pain. We can also practice this with some of the things which we have to do, which we don't like doing. The things which we disagree with. We can do this to overcome that fault-finding mind which I talk so much about in this monastery. I talk so much about it because it is one of the big problems for living happily in a monastery, in a community. It's a great problem for living happily and gaining deep meditation when one is sitting on one's cushion. That fault-finding mind is one of the big obstacles. And of course you can understand the fault-finding mind is again very far removed from equanimity, from just looking. Here, with a fault-finding mind, you're looking and the the sanya, the perception, is actually searching out things to complain about. It's a fascinating aspect of the mind to be able to see and to be able to capture this essence because you see this creates so much suffering and disappointment and problems for you for lifetimes. Why is it that the mind is bent on finding faults? Sure, the faults are there, but they're also surrounded by things which aren't faulty at all, things we can find gratitude towards, things you can develop loving kindness towards, things you can develop the beautiful nimitta towards, things you can be at peace with. Why is it that many human beings always incline towards finding faults? Finding faults with their fellows in the holy life, finding faults in the monastery, finding faults in themselves, finding faults in the Dhamma, finding faults in their meditation cushion. It's too lumpy. It's not good enough. You can see that that fault-finding mind creates work. It creates conflict. It creates things to do. It goes in the opposite direction to peace. So the equanimity is that when we look at something which we cannot change in the monastery, in our daily lives, when there's something which is irritating us, by developing equanimity towards it, I'm not talking about physical pain, I'm talking about just irritations in the schedule, in the routine or whatever, we can develop an equanimity to it when we can't change it. And we know we have that equanimity towards that irritation if the mind starts to become peaceful again. There's nothing we can do, so we do nothing. We just sit and be. And if it's true equanimity, because there's a lack of activity for the mind, it's fully accepting, it's just looking on, the doer, the fault-finding mind, has ceased. The mind has to develop a sense of stillness and a sense of peace. So very often, that if when you start sitting in meditation there's something irritating you, whether it's a thought from the past or whether it's an ache in the bottom or whether it's too cold or too hot in your room, sometimes if you can't change it, you can't do anything about it, then try the developing of equanimity. For many years in my early life as a monk, I practiced that by just using a mantra called no desire, no desire, no desire. And I would use that mantra in the way that I encourage all mantras, all words, instructions to be used. I would say it, but I would listen to it afterwards, listen to its echo, and listen or watch, observe my mind, just looking in the direction those words were pointing, and following in that direction. When I said no desire, I would watch my mind just following obediently and having no desire for a few seconds. Then I'd have to say it again to remind the mind, no desire, no desire. No desire was no doer, it was letting go. However, that I did notice that sometimes it didn't work, and the reason was, again, the mindfulness, the clarity was not strong enough to be able to do that. I thought I was doing no desire, but there was underlying desires, undercurrents of craving, which I couldn't see, which I hadn't really perceived in my mental landscape yet. It was only later on you'd realize why that didn't work, but at least you could get rid of the worst of the defilements, cravings and the doings. So at least I can get to some degree of peacefulness. But certainly I hadn't just given up my desire to be aware of the five sense world, that underlying craving to see, to hear, to feel, to smell. Those underlying cravings were not even touched by that degree of letting be. Which is why that you found afterwards that that superficial equanimity needed a bit more. That you had to develop a way, a means, so that you could take the mind from the world of activity into the world of letting go, to bring it to equanimity through actually doing things. And the way of developing the deeper equanimities as you all know, is by developing the gradual perceptions of happiness. To see the happiness of not doing, the happiness of equanimity. And you had to turn off the switches of doing, the switches of controlling, the switches of desire, one by one, in the correct order, for it to work. And you start to see that the concern with the past and the future, and there was nothing to do with equanimity at all, nothing to do with just looking on. But there was, you were sending the mind off to the future, you were sending it to the past. I remember the instructions of meditation by the great teachers in Thailand. They always used to say, Yahe song jit ti ni ti non. Don't send the mind here and there. And they realized, those great teachers, that it wasn't the mind just going there by itself, that you, the meditator, were actually sending it there, you were ordering it there. Only that many people lacked the mindfulness to see that they were responsible. The mind going off to the future, the mind going off to the past, was a result of them willing it to go. A sign of them willing it away from the present moment. With deeper mindfulness, with deeper attention, you could actually see that. That the mind would naturally stay in the present moment if you let it. It's only when you are interested, when you valued the past, or when you're interested or valued the future, only then would you be sending it somewhere else. So seeing with deeper clarity just why the mind wandered off, you could develop equanimity there. Equanimity to the past, equanimity to the future, in the sense you weren't concerned about it at all. So the mind would settle all by itself into the present moment. You'd turn off the switch of doing the past and doing the future. In the same way that tourists go over to France or to England, they do France, they do England, they do United States. So you've done with all that doing. Finish with all that travelling into the past and the future. And with that degree of non-doing, you can see the next thing which you have to give up is the doing, the thinking. And again, because we value these things. Don't ever conceive that, well, I'll just watch the thinking and it will stop. I'll just be equanimous to it. I'll just see where the thinking goes, because it will just go everywhere. It won't stop that way. And the reason is because you're not just equanimous on the thought and the thinking process. If you really were equanimous and you didn't really care about the thinking process, it would stop. Because you care about it, because you value it, because you give it some degree of importance, that you will it along. This is interesting, this is fascinating. That's the reason why people continue to get lost in so much thought. And the thought is always one-sided, never the full description of the person or the event. So often in my life that I follow thought and assume that thought could describe the person I was thinking about. This one insight was that I could never judge another person. I could never figure them out. Thought could not do that. And I thought it was quite arrogant of me and extremely stupid to believe in any thoughts I had of another human being. So that straight away got rid of all justification for anger and ill will towards another. So instead you just started to disbelieve thinking, take away its value. And then you had equanimity, then you weren't trying to do the thinking, you weren't sending the mind off to thinking. And if it really is true, just looking on. Looking on is not talking about what you're looking at, it's just looking, nothing else. Just observing. And surely the thinking mind has to stop there. With the deepening of equanimity, with the deepening of just looking, just observing, you're coming close to what is traditionally called a silent observer. It's a very good metaphor for a deepening of equanimity, the deepening of upeka. The silent observer is someone who can look without saying anything. It's very hard for a person to do that. In the world, people look and they give their opinion or they give their orders, they say what should be done. Even in this monastery, it's very hard for someone to do anything without sort of giving their input into how it can be done better. It's usually how it can be done worse. But we all think it's how it can be done better. And that nature of the mind, why do we do that? Don't we want to have simple lives? It's enough having one abbot in the monastery, let alone sort of 20 abbots or 30 abbots. And if you really want to be abbot, just come along and I'll give you the job. One of the nice things about being a junior monk is that you don't have to make any decisions. All you need to do is just go and sit in a hut all day. However, when you're a junior monk, you want to make the decisions. When you're seated in the monk and have to make the decisions, it's the last thing you want to do. So that's just the craziness of life. But the equanimity there is just the bare attention, just watching, just looking. And it has to overcome the thinking mind. If you're practicing equanimity, things have to stop. And one of the things which should stop is the thoughts. Then you're in the center, as equanimity so sometimes means. In the equilibrium, not in the past, not in the future. Just right in the present moment. It's centering the mind. The thoughts always take it away from the center, or it's away from the present moment. Thoughts are usually old. Something which has happened in the past, which you're trying to describe and trying to find some meaning for. But it's something which is old, which has already happened, which is gone many moments ago. In the equilibrium of the present moment, equanimous, just watching, then you find that why is it that when you just watch in the moment, still the mind starts to go from one sense base to another? What makes it go from one sense base to another? So often again, it's a lack of the deepening of equanimity. Still there's a sense of control there, a sense of interest, what's happening in the ears, what's happening in the body, what's happening with the tones. With that interest, it goes again in the opposite direction to equanimity. You should be able to take one object, the breath, and have that just bare attention on the breath, just looking on the breath without trying to control it. And how often is it when people start to meditate, they can't get the breath to be calm and peaceful? And you know the reason why, they're just still controlling. Controlling the breath makes it very unpleasant. Leave it alone, let it go, and don't be concerned about it, and it's very easy. How often is it that we are listening to a talk, or we're eating our lunch, or we're walking back from the dining room to our huts, we breathe quite naturally, quite easily, quite comfortably, because we're not really paying any attention. Why is it that when we pay attention to things, they start to get uncomfortable? The reason is because when we pay attention to things, we always tend to get involved. It's the doer and the controller again. And it's the doer and the controller acting in a very subtle way which many people can't see. They're trying to make the breath peaceful and quiet, and it doesn't become peaceful and quiet. Why? It's because we're trying to do this. We're not practicing equanimity. We're actually doing something. So just in the same way when there's pain in the body, when there's irritation in your monastic life, in the same way when there's irritation in this breath you're having to watch, try equanimity, upeka. Not trying to change the way the breath is going in and out, not trying to make it longer or shorter or smoother or whatever, even if it's uncomfortable. You're going to be equanimous with this. Just leave it alone, just watch, with a sense of investigating, curious about what will happen next, but more curious about what's happening now. And if we can practice that degree of just looking on with equanimity, real upeka is a great tool of our meditation. If the breath starts to get quiet and starts to smooth out and become comfortable, there you've been practicing upeka. You get to know what upeka means. And also you get to know how to apply it. You practice upeka on the uncomfortable breath, and it turns into a very comfortable, peaceful breath. You get a lot of insight with such experiences, because that degree of upeka could actually develop the breath into the beautiful breath. I want the breath to be beautiful. What should I do next? Upeka, just look on, just wait, be patient, don't try and do things. The doer, the fault-finding mind, and the doer comes from the fault-finding mind. When it sees faults, it's not satisfied, it's not content, it's going to do something about it. It's just the nature, fault-finding mind, is the condition for doing. And once we have upeka, no fault-finding, we're just looking without judging, without valuing, without weighing one against another. We're not weighing the ordinary breath against the beautiful breath. We're not weighing the beautiful breath against the nimitta. We're not weighing nimittas against jhanas. We're not weighing anything. No value. We're just looking on and see what happens. And if we have done the upeka enough to turn the uncomfortable breath into a comfortable breath, we can very easily continue that degree of upeka. That just looking aspect of the mind. Just upeka, upeka, upeka. And just you'll notice the breath will get beautiful all by itself. And get soft, and get peaceful, and get slow, and get refined, and get calm. Because again, this is what upeka does. Upeka takes the business away. Takes all the disturbance away. It takes the wind from the leaf. So the leaf starts to wobble and vibrate less and less and less. This is just what you're seeing. The mind vibrating less and less and less. As it gets more and more still, it gets more and more beautiful, more and more energy. But be careful in those stages when you start to get energy in the beautiful breath and lots of PT coming up. Because that can just excite the mind. And so instead of looking on with upeka, you start to get excited. Looking on with excitement. Wow, this is really good. At last I'm getting somewhere. That's not upeka. That's another type of wind. You start to shake the leaf again. If you develop that upeka at the very beginning, you can very easily carry it through as a very important aspect, part of your attention. Remember also upeka is just looking clearly. Be very careful here that when the breath becomes very refined, you don't get lost in the lack of mindfulness, where you can't really see clearly what's going on. If you cultivate upeka, it's a very clear seeing, but a very silent seeing. It's like seeing just with eyes and having no hands to mess things up. Just the armless seer. If you can start to do this, then everything starts to happen as a natural process. Because the doer has been taking away, because you're just looking on with upeka, just when the beautiful parts of the meditation start to happen, the beautiful breath and the nimitta starts to come up, the mind doesn't wobble and shake, because it's been set up with upeka. It's been generating the ability just to look on clearly without getting involved. Just to be a spectator to the whole process. And if you're just a spectator to the whole process, the process takes over and carries you into beautiful nimittas. And you don't care whether that turns into a jhana or whether it disappears or where it goes or what it does, because your job is just to look. You are the passive observer, just like a person in an aeroplane, just looking out the window. You can't tell the pilot to go faster, to go slower. as the pilot will go according to his own nature. Your job is just to look out of the window, upeka. This is what you're doing, just looking out of the window of the mind onto all these beautiful things happening. And if you're just looking, you're just looking without fear, without excitement, without doing anything, with real upeka, there's no fear, there's no excitement. If any fear, excitement comes up, it means you've lost that upeka. And then you get into the jhanas. With that upeka as your the key which you enter jhanas, that becomes an inclination of the mind. With that inclination of the mind prominent when you enter the first jhana, that will take you through the first wobble of the mind in the first jhana, the wobble of vitakka vichara, of the mind just going to the object and trying to hold it. Upeka will see that as a doing, as a movement of the mind. Even though it's subtle and pre-verbal, the inclination to upeka will be able to unlock and discard that last bit of doing. Upeka will be able to develop into the second jhana, where there's absolute stillness. The piti is still in the second jhana, the upeka will be able to discard that. So joyful, so what? We'd be able to just look. And because it's just looking and inclining towards not giving any more energy to that piti, that just like the leaf will begin to wobble less and less and less, until that will just give way to the most refined sukha you've ever experienced. But if the inclination towards upeka has been strong in the beginning, it will be maintained in the middle, and it will be able to be the cause and the reason to abandon even the sukha and to abide in the fourth jhana, where it's just the perfection of upeka. Purely mindful, but no doing at all, no movement of the mind. Not in any which way. There, you can have a summit of upeka. And if you can experience something like that, you just know the full meaning of that word, what upeka really means, that how you can just look on without doing anything until everything starts to disappear, until everything disappears, all doing gone. And to develop the arupa jhanas, the upeka has got to look back upon itself. Just looking without concern on the looker, on consciousness itself. Not being concerned about being conscious. Not generating the energy which fuels consciousness. So that consciousness itself, rather than the objects of consciousness not vibrating, just the consciousness itself stops to vibrate, little by little by little, through the arupa jhanas, until through the non-doing of consciousness, even consciousness can cease. The upeka of upeka, until that ceases too. And experiences such as that, when one comes out afterwards, just underscores just the problem of this thing we call the doer. And you can start to see this problem we call the doer, why upeka is so difficult to do, is because the doer, consciousness, they're all taken to be a self, to be me, to be mine, to be my problem, to be something which I am concerned about, which is something which is so close to me that we cling to it no matter what. We have to see that through the practice of upeka all these things disappear, so we can uncover this truth of anatta. There is nobody in here. The five khandhas are just empty completely. There's no one who who owns these khandhas. These khandhas don't constitute a self or a soul. There's nothing there. And then through the experiment of upeka, just trying it out to see if it fits, we get so close we can see these truths. As soon as those truths are seen, that upeka becomes just a natural manifestation of that insight. Upeka, when we see that there is no one who owns this, why should we cling to these things? When we know that this is just the play of nature, why should we just try and do all of this? It's just like when we understand at long last that rain will come and sun will come according to nature, and who can predict it? No one can. But we stop craving to be sunny day or craving for rain, or we can't, it's a stupid thing to crave for such things, they're completely out of our control. In the same way that we stop craving for pleasure and for pain, we stop craving for things to be this way and that way according to our convenience. What about other people's convenience? Why do we always want things to be our way? In the end, we know we can't get our own way. We give up, we let go, we abandon. And we didn't develop that equanimity to the world. No, we cannot control. All that we can do is to guide from time to time. The Arahat who has been through that process has seen the value of equanimity. We'll have equanimity as an enlightenment factor. And that equanimity, of encouraging that equanimity in others, would manifest as the other of the Brahma Viharas. His beautiful loving kindness, compassion and sympathetic joy. If there's something to do, they will do something for others to try and encourage that same equanimity. When there's that full equanimity established there, then there's no more karma formations manifesting. That which creates rebirth. You know, the distinction between pleasure and pain, distinction between what I like, what I don't like, all that sort of disappearing, just equanimity. That degree of equanimity, just looking on with curiosity. So the causes of rebirth you can see so easily have sort of disappeared. The equanimity is like the fire gone out. It's cool. The craving is like the hot, the fire. The more you crave, the more you desire, the more you want, the more ill will is going to come up in your mind, the more anger you're going to have towards yourself, towards the world, or towards whatever. Remember, the fire burns anything. And it's not the wood's fault, it's not the paper's fault, it's not the grass's fault. It's the fire that can burn anything. It's the fire's fault for being hot. So it's not somebody else's fault if you're angry with them or ill will, it's your fault. There's not enough equanimity there. There's not enough peace, there's not enough stillness. The more there's that craving there, there's the more the karma is being made. And the more that you're making your future births, you're making your future abidings in this world. Abidings of suffering. That equanimity there, with the real equanimity which I've been describing, the equanimity which leads to silence, which leads to peace, which leads to stillness, which leads to jhanas, which leads to the ending of things. Those equanimities are the equanimities which lead to nibbana. And so this is the way we can practice this. Again, to sum up, be very careful. Equanimity is not just sort of allowing things to be. Unless, when you allow it to be, it starts to disappear and get quiet and still and peaceful. Always measure equanimity by the degree of stillness it creates. For seeing if it ends things, if it leads to viraga, the fading away of the problem, if it leads to the leaf starting to get peaceful and still. Test it out. And then once you know what equanimity truly is, you can use it in all aspects of your life. To be able to, if you have to give a talk somewhere, if you have to go to Melbourne for the weekend when you don't really want to, you have to do all these things which you don't really like to do. You develop equanimity so that they don't move the mind, they don't worry the mind, they don't make the mind shake and tremble. You can use it in the meditation practice, you can use it at the time when you're sick, you can use it in the time when you die. Without that equanimity, born of letting go. And then you can be free. So please, if you find that the subject of upekkha, just looking, silent awareness, looking, having eyes but no hands, see if that can assist your happiness in this monastery, your contentment in monastic life, and especially help and assist the depth of your meditation. So that's the talk this evening on upekkha, on equanimity. Has anyone got any questions on that talk? Okay.
Sukhati Pano Bhagavan.